Good evening, everybody. The film goes for a little under 2 hours, so we should start very soon. My name is Simon Rice. I'm at the AMU College of Law, where I have the refreshed title of Director of Law Reform and Social Justice, which means I'm able to do exciting things like this, bringing you the opportunity to engage in what should be a very current Australian political and social debate. I'm going to say a couple of words and then we'll start the film. The film runs for a little under 2 hours and then we'll have a question and answer session to take us through to 8:30. So if you're planning on leaving, your first opportunity to leave without being conspicuous will be about 8 o'clock and then another half hour. I've been asked by one of the many people I work with to organise this, Steph, to remind you or ask you to like our Facebook page, because that's very important to us. Many of you here, because you like our Facebook page, it's, I'm looking at Steph, you got it right, ANU
Law Reform and Social Justice.
ANU Law Reform and Social Justice. Please do that much for us. The rest of it's free. I mentioned to a colleague that we were putting on Utopia, and as some of you know, it's been on around the place. And my colleague said, "Ooh, that's controversial." And I resisted the two one-word answers that came to mind. One was, yes, and the other was, so. And what I did say was, why? Why is it controversial? Why do you think it's controversial? And she said, well, it's very one-sided, isn't it? And I said, well, yeah, maybe it's a side worth listening to. Maybe this is the side that you don't get to hear. If, as you watch it, you feel it's one-sided, go out and find out more. Take this as a chance to engage in the debate. Find out what you think might be another side to it. There's nothing in the film that isn't true. There's no CGI in this film. Once you accept that everything you see is true, then I think it might make more sense to you that I believe it's very important that we see what is this side of the film. And at the end, you'll have a chance to ask questions of an expert panel who will be introduced to you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to the screening of Utopia. My name is Frank Acker, and I'm a staff member and a student here at the ANU, and I work with the Law Reform Social and Social Justice Centre to put on the screening of Utopia for you tonight. I first of all just want to thank everybody for coming along to the screening. I don't think I can express how important I think this film is and the content that it shows, and I hope that everybody here managed to take something away from what you've just witnessed. We have a Q&A panel here, and hopefully if there are any questions that people have, you'll be able to ask them and receive an answer from the panel. What we'll do to start off with is just start off with a couple of minutes from each panel member to just give their opinion on not only the film, but the issues that the film raises. Just to inform you all, we do have recording of the Q&A session, but they will not be recording any of the questions that you ask, so don't feel afraid to ask questions thinking that your voice is going to be on tape, because it won't be. So feel free to say what you like. So I'll just introduce the speakers here. We have Janara Gurren-Graham, who's an assistant professor of Indigenous Studies at the Ngunnawal Centre at the University of Canberra. We have John Altman here, who is a professor in economics and anthropology at the Centre for Aboriginal and Economics Policy Research here in the College of Asia, College of Arts and Social Sciences. And we have Anthony Wood, who is he was a senior research fellow and high degree research manager for the National Centre for Indigenous Studies at ANU. So what we might do is just start off with Janara.
So if all of you could just, I'm going to sing first. Every time I watch Utopia, it brings back many years of, or 2 years particularly, of memories. It was quite a big deal, the whole business around Lakeline. So I'm going to sing this song because it's actually a very healing song. And I know that for all of you, that's a really hard film to watch. So this is an ancient sacred song that was passed down in the women in our clans for thousands of years, and I would like to share it with you as a tribute to my relatives who are in the field and all the Aboriginal people who have gone before us who have suffered the oppressive governments of this country since invasion. So if you would close your eyes in honour of the women that held this song and passed it on for our healing and our medicine, I would like to make it part of my talk. Advice, but on the way to Mutajulu in the Qantas Club on the Monday that followed him doing the interview with Late Night on the Friday, I said to him, I've got a couple of messages for you from the men that you've just had a consultation with, the National Indigenous Leadership Group, and they've asked me to tell you to be careful of the way you talk to Aboriginal people because it's not very useful and people are very offended. And I told him this and he said, do you know what I'm doing here and what I do? And I said, well, yeah, you're a public servant, you're helping Aboriginal people, you're writing policy. And he said, no, actually, I'm not here for the blackfellas. I'm here for the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs. And you know what they used to call me at the Department of Foreign Affairs before I came here? And I said, no, what was that, Greg? And he said, I'm the baby-faced assassin. And I said, what's that mean? And he said, it means that I'm very good at going in and finding out what people are up to, and then I screw them over very quickly. And I thought, this is very dangerous. What am I doing now? I'm going to deal with this guy. And we get out there, and on the way out, we stop to look at the rock, and he gets out to have a glass of water or a bottle of water. And we're just standing there under a tree, and he says to me, you know, Bob Randall is a pedophile. And I just was so shocked. I said, what do you mean, Bob Randall is a pedophile? And he told me this story about how he was told by a group of people that the man who was very highly respected and highly regarded, that was going around the world, around the country, talking about coming in, living in unconditional love and harmony with all new things, who had spent his life working to change what had happened in Australia in his own life, was a pedophile, and that there were a bunch of pedophiles in Wurundjeri. I've been going to Wurundjeri for nigh on 30 years, and I knew there was not. And so I said to him, you know, it's very dangerous saying that sort of thing. You need to be quiet. And I thought then that something was going to go on that I would have absolutely no control over. A couple of days later, he accused me of leaking confidential information from a meeting with a number of youth workers. I told him I couldn't do it. I got back to Canberra 3 days later, and my security passes to the office in the garage under the building wouldn't work. I was very tired from my trip, so I took a week off. A week later, the police came and raided our house. And my 22-year-old university daughter was at home on the day, and I'd been called to a meeting all of a sudden. And I got a phone call to say, the police are here, and they're looking through the house and they're tearing everything upside down. And I'm sitting there wondering what on earth is going on. And so for the next 2 years, the government took me to court for giving frank and fearless advice about not using the army to go into Wurundjeri. And so the policy of the intervention had already been written, had already been decided a year before it was put in place. And I'd seen a number of emails about it because it was my job, it came across my desk. And I had written back to Greg and to the Minister's office and said, this is not really a good idea, we're in the middle of the national consultation, and why would we do this anyway, what's going on? And so I knew then that something very secretive was going on, that had been going on for a long time, and that they were up to something that none of us would have any control over. So for the next few 2 years, I was suspended from my job. I was told not to come to work. I was paid my salary. And then I was taken to court and charged with a criminal act of leaking public service documents, emails to my relatives at Wurundjeri. And I absolutely admit that I did that, but I did it after I saw the Late Line story, because I knew that Greg, who had intended to go on that program fully visible, had disguised himself for a reason, and that the minister and he and the government were up to something. And so I did choose to tell my relatives at Wurundjeri that the army, they were intending to send the army out there. And the reason I did that was because at some point, as an Aboriginal person working in the public service at a high level, there's a decision, a moral decision that you have to make. Often it comes to that point. You compromise yourself and you go with them, or you you make a choice to be in the firing line. And so that's how I got to be in the film Utopia, because I made that choice and as a result went bankrupt because I couldn't afford all the legal fees. That was nearly $300,000, sold my house. So personally, you know, none of those things were such a big deal to me. I knew once I made the decision that my job was gone and my life would be turned upside down. I knew that. And so I did it because it was wrong. It was wrong to do that to people who live in abject poverty. You see on the film that they do. It was wrong to do it to people who so gently just live out in that place, live out on the land, who just want to have what everybody else has in terms of running water, good housing, proper food. You know, they live like people in a third world country still. And it's true what he says in the film. That's exactly how they live. I was there 2 weeks ago with my grandmother, Barbara Jikatu, and she was doing a painting that was going to the Duchess of Cambridge, and they painted it with, we would laugh about this, they painted it with Rufus Hare Wallaby poo, and for the very proper reason of telling them, you know, to get lost, because they're very clever, they know what's going on. But they have no power at all. And so it's very easy for a government to use all its resources to get what they want. And we knew very early on that the intervention was not about pedophiles, because there were none. It was not about pornography, because you can go down to Fishwick and get as much as you like. It wasn't about grog, because Aboriginal people don't drink any more than anyone else in Australia. And actually, Australians drink a lot more grog than blackfellas do. That's my opinion, my evidenced opinion. And we knew that they were after the land. It was like the campaign for the uniform land rights legislation. You know, they wanted it for mining. There are very rare and important minerals on Aboriginal land. And only Aboriginal people want to live out there because it's their land. They want Aboriginal people to move. They have spent many years trying to get people to move from Wurundjeri. And that's the truth of it. And yet they use these very underhanded ways of behaving, secret ways of behaving in government, and use the public service to help them do it by keeping it secret. And I'm very grateful that it all happened to me, because I don't have to work there anymore. I don't have to do what I thought I was doing, which was to help change the system, to help make it better for our mob. Yeah. So I probably talk longer than 5 minutes, Frank. So thank you for coming to watch the film. And I hope that in your hearts, each of you chooses to make a difference to our country and help us keep the laws of respect and the laws of community and unconditional love and harmony in our land, because that's truly how this land should be governed. Thank you. You're welcome.
Your personal experience, especially in regards to the issues that the film raises, is invaluable for everybody in this room here. So I was happy to let you keep speaking. So if we could just get John up now.
Thank you very much, Frank. And thanks, Janara. You're one of my favourite whistleblowers, you know that. Look, I was asked to participate in John Pilger's film. And I thought about it for about 3 minutes, and I decided to participate because much of what I read in the dominant media told me John Pilger was a ratbag, he wasn't to be trusted, and he'd made an outrageous, sensational movie. And I guess I didn't really believe any of that. what I thought was we might get somebody who is a esteemed journalist from outside Australia to have the benefit of just looking in and saying something about what was going on in this country. John Pilger, since the making of Utopia, has been pilloried by the mainstream media as being a FIFO-E, a fly-in, fly-out expatriate. And I remember having a cup of coffee with him after seeing the film for the first time and telling him that I thought that, you know, this was really quite a compliment, you know, somebody who was from this country, who lived overseas, but kept coming back to scrutinise Australia. But John didn't actually take it that way. He thought that Gerard Henderson was having really having a go at him. I think that I've seen this film four times now. I think if I've got a criticism of John, is he tries to do too much. There's an awful amount of information in that film. And every time I see it, I see something different in it. The best showing of the film I've seen was at the University of Canberra, where, again, I was on a panel with Janara, and there were four excerpts of the film shown of 10 minutes each. And I think that that's plenty to digest in one sitting. I think 2 hours, in some ways, raises too many questions about where Australia is going in relation to Indigenous affairs. He traverses the continent, he traverses over time, he traverses many issues. And I guess, you know, my allegiance to the film and my involvement in it really arose much more from the Northern Territory intervention and my opposition to it from 21 June 2007, where I could very clearly see what was very darkly going on in relation to intervening in people's lives and looking to change them. Morality and to normalise Indigenous communities in the way that I thought was quite unacceptable in plural, you know, late democratic Australia. Since then, though, in some ways I've seen that what John's done is, you know, really go much wider than intervention, and I've also seen he's produced a movie that's very much targeting overseas audiences so that in some ways Indigenous people can get traction internationally, particularly because it's so difficult for them to have a political voice in Australia. And I think that the whole notion that Nancy Fraser raises about intramestic politics is extraordinarily important for Indigenous people. They won't necessarily get social justice through people like you who are here to look and learn about what's going on in remote Indigenous Australia, but they might if Australia is internationally shamed. And I think that one of the real strengths of this movie is that it is targeting international audiences. But on the other hand, I do agree with some Indigenous people in this country, particularly Australian of the Year, Adam Goods, who believes that every Australian should see this movie. And I think that's the case. Again, you may agree or disagree with it. You may agree or disagree with the directions that John Pilger takes. But I think he does present a lot of factual information that all Australians should at least have a look at and then make their own minds about what they think about it. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We'll just get Asmita Knopf and say a couple of words and then we'll go to Q&A.
Hi everybody. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional people on the land on which we meet. I wasn't involved in the film at all, but I've seen excerpts of it and found it quite confronting to deal with even in small bits. 2 hours and I feel a bit stunned actually, and I'm not quite sure that I can say anything really sensible about it. All I can say is that a lot of what's happening in the film happens in many communities across the country. And while I'm sure it's also confronting, you know, for people like yourself, many non-Indigenous people, and I'd like to acknowledge the Indigenous people in the audience, our elders and others. It really helps us to take our case overseas. Sir Robert Menzies did what he did and helped the first, the 1967 referendum because of his desire to criticize South Africa and to be able to speak on the international plane with some dignity. I think the younger generations that are coming up and who have a better understanding of race relations in Australia can really help us to solve our problems. We don't need other people to help us solve our problems. We are an ancient people with incredible wisdom among us, and we don't really need other people to come and tell us what to do. We survived for 60,000 years without any kind of intervention. What we have to do now is to regroup and learn and relearn how to live among the community. As a lady in the film said, we will not respond in kind. We will not do to us what has been, we will not do to other people what has been done to us. This is not our way. But we will learn how to engage in a way that is acceptable primarily to ourselves and on our terms, but to learn how to live and to regain our land and the dignity that we possess. So I'll leave it to Frank to open the floor to questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Rasmi. So we have Stephanie over here with a microphone. And if anybody has questions, you could just raise your hand and I'll point you out and then Steph will run to you. If you've got Connor at the back, I know your name. I've shamed you in public.
Connor, hold on, I have a microphone.
Hi, I'd just like to thank the speakers for coming along. I suppose one of the things that struck me about the film was just one particular one amongst others, and there's gallons of information to take in, obviously, but there was one Arendi woman who spoke about the idea that there'd been no attempts at treaties, and let me have some time to explain this quickly. Maybe she was speaking on behalf of the Arendi, but there is, I suppose, examples like the Treaty Organization of Victoria, led by John Batman, and obviously Batman's not a great example of reconciliation, but I suppose his organization did try to set up something like a treaty, and there were humanitarian motivations to that. And I mean, other examples, maybe stuff like the sorry books, people are trying to sign something. And open in terms of written language, a way to dialogue and to negotiate the way that people live on the country. And I suppose I just asked if any of the panelists are aware of any sort of maybe other examples or if they had any comments on the way that I suppose possible negotiations of treaty or attempts at treaty making or attempts at agreement have been made in the past.
I think that my understanding of Batman's treaty was that he wasn't representing the Crown. He was representing business interests in Van Diemen's land. I guess that stands out from, I think it was 1835, as the only known attempt at a treaty with Indigenous nations in this country. And I think what is particularly unusual about Australia as a settler colony is the absence of treaties. I think that some people have said to John Pulger that his film doesn't really end with any hope. But I think that the one element of hope at the end of that film is his suggestion that there are a set of treaties with Indigenous nations, and also possibly, I think, in relation to different issues that confront Indigenous communities. Sometimes I wonder if treaties are the way to go. I think that there needs to be, first and foremost, a national recognition of the fact that Australia and Indigenous people have been illegally dispossessed and that they never ceded sovereignty to the British Crown. And I think that that's the starting point to negotiate where we might go in the future. But that's an extraordinary thing to say, I think, in 2014. After, again, what was shown in that film as being quite a limited apology, not in relation to what was done to Indigenous people, but in relation to the stolen generations. So I think that there's a whole raft of issues that we really need to address, and treaties might be one way of doing this. I think that when we look at other settler colonies, mainly Canada, the United States, and New Zealand, where you've had a treaty or treaties, this has become quite a strong rallying point for modes of community self-determination, tribal self-determination, and forms of sovereignty that we just do not see countenance in Australia, and without which I don't think we'll really have progress in addressing what we call the Indigenous problem, but of course what the Indigenous people call the problem of, you know, illegal colonisation.
So, hello, can you hear me? I'm basically going to tell you that we should be doing what Aboriginal people want here. Sovereignty was never ceded, and we are a sovereign people. That's actually the issue here. I think treaties are absolutely gone by the by, let's just forget about treaties. Aboriginal people, essentially, the close majority of Aboriginal people do not want treaty to go down the treaty track again. We, Bob Hawke agreed at Barunga to agree to a negotiation of a treaty, and it went on for a very long time. It became a Makarrata, it became a this, it became a that. Then it became uniform land rights legislation, which didn't work either. And there's just this complete denial that there has been no recognition of prior custodianship of this country. It was an empty land. Then, yes, okay, the Murray Islanders had this unbroken connection, so now we have native title. But let's just finish all that business, because in our view, we are a sovereign people who've never had our sovereignty recognised. And Aboriginal people want their sovereignty recognised. The Aboriginal Provisional Government, since the late 70s, early 80s, has always said that's the main game. And now there's a very strong movement amongst all of us for a sovereignty. For sovereignty. It's always been what we've done internationally, is to try and have that recognised. Why can we not have that recognised? I know there's a lot of legal mumbo-jumbo about why that cannot happen. As far as I'm concerned, it's a moral issue, it's an ethical issue, it's not entirely a legal issue. And for one, I'm 55, and from the age of 13 when I began working in Aboriginal land rights and political activism, because my uncle got killed on a nigger hunt in 1972 in Western Queensland where we lived, I'm just done with white people and the government saying they cannot recognise the prior sovereignty of Aboriginal people. Are we just going to ignore that we're all here and that and half of our people live in abject poverty and have no power in terms of political power? I just don't think that's okay or a fair go from the dominant culture in the fair go country. And it's time to just give up on treaties. We're done with treaties. It's time to have a serious conversation about sovereignty recognition.
As Janara has said, I don't think any Indigenous group has ceded sovereignty, and I think
that is a starting point. The fact that there is no treaty means that there was never a negotiation at which we could have ceded our sovereignty at law. A treaty is a legal instrument between two equal parties, more or less. And I don't think that in our current position that we either have the strength or the equality to negotiate with people we don't frankly trust. I mean, I don't trust the politicians, and I think I can speak for the majority of Aboriginal people in saying that certainly in terms of our legal rights that we wouldn't trust what they had to say. So I don't think a treaty is the right thing at the moment, but there are practical issues that can be addressed. And the fact, well, when I was a child, I would have never, ever expected so many non-Indigenous people to attend a session where they were talking about Indigenous issues, and some very, very high up people here, you know, professors and vice-chancellors, pro-vice-chancellors, and, you know, God knows, you know, and future leaders of our country. So I think the future holds hope for us, because there may be a time when people will negotiate with us in good faith and with not just the legalities, but with the moralities of the issues being strongly considered and being the foundation of a set of negotiations.
All right, so we had a question up here. If anybody else has any questions, just raise your hand and I'll note you, and then I'll come to you next.
I'm a private citizen, and I am deeply interested in the issue that brought up by that gentleman there tonight. Mate, stay the hell away from a treaty, because it's an abrogation, because it's a recognition that you're a black guy on that side of the fence, and I'm a white guy on this side of the fence, and you can go and get me. Don't go near a treaty. We have to, in this country, take a step over the line to see that every single person is a human being. And if you have a treaty, you have a way to wipe them. Don't go near a treaty, mate. We have to make what you say there, the issue of sovereignty must never be settled by a treaty, because that's a ceding. There must be like that, the WIC people thing, where there is no resolution to how the principles of WIC operate. It's simply a case of there is original sovereignty, there is original custodianship, and there is historical coming here. I'm a white guy coming out of the history. But the point is, if it can't be resolved, we still have to face each other as a human being to a human being without a back fence involved. Mate, don't go near a treaty. There's too much to gain from to interlocutory, if that's what you want to call it. Don't go near a treaty.
I think we'll just take that as a comment, and we might just take one or two more questions and just wrap up in the next 5 minutes or so, because I know people have been here for a while and they probably won't get home. So we just have Steph, who's up there. Pointing to Will. I couldn't see
his face.
Thank you.
I'd like to hand to someone who's signed a white man.
I'm Amy. Thank you.
Australia needing foreign assistance in dealing with this issue, was really born of deep depression about the current bipartisanship amongst powerful political parties in Australia that seem to be quite comfortable pursuing a broad brush policy of what you might call assimilation, integration, mainstreaming or normalisation, as if somehow this is going to make a difference. And one of the truly depressing things since the extraordinary supposed effort that's been made in the Northern Territory since the intervention nearly 7 years ago now, is that if anything, things in the Northern Territory have got worse, not better, but the two major political parties are acquiescing in an approach that's failing. And it's an approach that's born of history, because that approach has really been tried in one way or another since the killing times ended, and since there was approaches to Indigenous policy that were grounded in assimilation. So in making my comments about how a developmental approach from overseas would possibly better inform policy making, I'm certainly not suggesting that Australian citizens should be absolved from being involved in this issue. And frankly, like other speakers, I'm extraordinarily pleased to see so many people here this evening. And I think that we can all take responsibility and take political action in relation to the sorts of issues that we're becoming aware of. I think it is difficult in Australia, given the nature of our political system, and given the domination of our media, and given, as hinted at in that film, some of the very powerful alliances between the political and bureaucratic classes in this country and capitalist interests in relation to how Indigenous lands and Indigenous peoples are treated today. But I don't think that precludes us from trying to take domestic political action under the broad umbrella of social justice to ensure that there's recognition, there's due forms of representation for Indigenous people, and that there is proper redistribution for Indigenous people in terms of the ills and the legacies that have historically been left behind. Unfortunately, it just strikes me, a year after that film's been made, that in some ways we're moving backwards in relation to all these issues. We're not moving forwards. And we see this just in the present with the dilution of Indigenous representation. So the National Congress is going to be defunded, and the only advice to government is coming from an appointed, not elected, Indigenous Advisory Council. And of course, people here be very well aware that iconic legislation for Indigenous people, the Racial Discrimination Act, which is suspended from time to time in relation to Indigenous issues, is going to be diluted at the same time as the government talks about constitutional recognition. So I think that there are, you know, I'm quite despondent about the way things have gone domestically, even since this film was made. And I would encourage, you know, in Australian people and people that are studying in Australia from overseas to really have a say on these issues in any way and in any form that they can.
Thanks, John. As John was speaking, I began to think about the Sami government in Norway, and how is it possible that in Australia we cannot have the same kind of respect for Aboriginal people that other countries have, and particularly Norway, because they have their own Indigenous people seen as a group of elders of state by the government of the country, and they govern together. And why cannot not be the case in Australia? I also am quite depressed about living for nearly 56 years and seeing and being politically active since the age of 13, and on the front lines through the 80s and the 90s, and here in Canberra and other places, and not seeing any change but things going backwards. Some of the things that have changed is that those of us who got educated in the 70s and the 80s and now the 90s, you know, we looked like proper Migloos, except with black skin. You know, I'm educated, I can talk your language, we can all do what we're supposed to do and look like assimilated Australians. But but I can never refer to myself as an Australian. I just can't. You know, that's the invading language of my country. This is Nunjanatiya, my mother. That's the name we give to this country. And I can see no reason why we cannot have equal government of Aboriginal people based on our cultural law of elders and others, and non-Aboriginal people. There's no reason why we can't be each half of the circle governing a country that we all love together in collaboration, cooperation, and true democracy and true equality. But I think with the Westminster system and the system that you have here, it can never really happen. The only things that have ever changed in Aboriginal affairs is when there was direct political action and when there were a lot of Aboriginal people frightening all the white people that we were going to take up arms against them. And that's the only time things ever got changed. The Vietnam War stopped because of the marches on the streets. I don't know if that's what we're supposed to do now, but I really don't know how to make change happen when you're a minority with not much power, unless the people with the power and the dominant culture, like all of you, are willing to walk beside all of us. We all walked across the bridge, lots of bridges, and there was a lot of caring and sharing. And really, that's all that Aboriginal people want to do. We want to care and share for our country. But the reality is, you're lied to by the media, and you're lied to by the government about who and what we really are. And the reason we haven't had a civil war or taken up arms against white people in the last 150 years is because our cultural law tells us that that's not what we're supposed to do. We are supposed to be a non-violent people who share a law of harmony to keep this land in harmony. And so we just quietly go about doing it because that's all we can do. Oh, and I should say you can do that with us.
I think knowledge and understanding between peoples are the best ways to build bridges. As we have learned your language and your laws and your cultures, I think perhaps it's time now for some reciprocity, and that those of you who can learn something about our ways and our languages and our laws and our spiritualities. We have mostly lived in peace, and that's the way we are, and we don't react to the way other people treat us. I think there's a tremendous amount that you can learn from us as we learn from you, and this will not just bring a greater degree of harmony and peace to the land on which we live, but it will also bring, I think, a great degree of peace and harmony to your own lives, because you will benefit from the accumulated and the accretion of wisdom that we have in this land. So all I can do is repeat what Janara said, and that is walk the mile with us, and maybe we can learn from each other.
I'm going to close the Q&A now, just because we've reached a quarter to nine, and I understand people have been sitting here for nearly 3 hours, and that we only have the room for 9 o'clock also, so we can just debate. So what I would like to do is just invite, just first of all, thank the speakers for coming along and providing their time.
I'm going to ask your indulgence for James to tell me 15 seconds. He has an important, relevant thing to bring to your attention.
Just in the spirit of all that has happened tonight, I'd just like to point out that the ANU Art School will be hosting a number of Mutijulu artists from the 14th of May There will be an exhibition of their artworks. There will be an opportunity to sit down and learn, undertake a dot painting workshop with a number of very, very talented Mutijulu artists to buy a number of their works, but also to see the displays of some of their finest pieces within the ANU. So I strongly recommend you all get along to that.
And you may know to ask what the paint's made of. A small gift for each of them, Mother and Esme, for being here tonight. Can you join me in thanking them? Thank you for being here. It was Frank's idea. He called me and said we should do it, and I had no hesitation. Thank you very much for your faith in his idea that people on campus care about this. I hope you heard the call to arms. Do what you can to follow through with the lesson, even if it's just going and finding out more. Thanks.
Good to see you again.